Resurrected Republic, Truth Radio Broadcast, on RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, tonight should be an interesting show. We are waiting any moment now for Jake Morfonios of Blackstone Intelligence to go live with Adam Green of No More News. We're going to be simulcasting their presentation regarding their trip to Israel and Palestine. So before we get to that, and while we're waiting for them to come online, which should be any second now, there were some comments out of the president had to say today. Knowing the crowd that I follow up after the show that's on before me, I know that you guys will really be interested in this. Look, fellas, I'm the most conservative Christian I know. And if you view people throwing rocks at you from the other side of a fence as if somebody had a rifle, you're an idiot. We have active denial systems that would give you a suntan from hell. We would never need to raise a rifle. If I were given three squads, or even one squad, and three of those active denial systems, I could turn every one of that crowd, even that huge crowd that you saw bust the gates in Mexico, I could run them crying like babies back from whence they came. I'm not really crazy about that technology. I think that it could be problematic when it's used against us, when we want to or feel the need to protest or take a stand against injustice here. However, I would much rather people use the active denial system than rifles. And the recent comments from the president, I did a video. I put it out on YouTube. I took a little bit of a beating, but you know what? So be it. Because I worship no man but Jesus Christ. So as far as I'm concerned, every other man that comes after that is fallible. And certainly if you don't think that Trump or anyone else for that matter, my brother, if you don't think we're fallible, then you're just part of a cult of personality. You're not really thinking clearly with your mind. You're just part of a cult. You know, the office of the presidency has been a real big problem. Mike, as far as your question, I don't believe we're going to add them in here. We're just going to patch the stream in live as soon as it goes live. I'm rejacking this to see if they have done so. They are working on Skype, then patch them in. Patch them in. If he said, if they can patch us in, I'll mute out when they go live. Let's see if. Okay, you might want to just make a mention to him and say, hey, look, Adam, we're simulcasting you. Patch us into the Skype stream, and we will mute out. I would like that would be a purer feed. It would be more beneficial. So, but like I said, these guys, whenever all of us try and get together and do the same thing at the same time, it's like herding cats. Anyway, it is what it is, so. I know that they're trying to get things going right now. So I don't know what they want to do. Ladies and gentlemen, just bear with me for a minute because I am multitasking at the moment trying to communicate through the back end here. I really would like to make this happen here. This would be a really cool thing to simulcast. Hang on. Be patient with us, folks. I'm talking with Adam on the back burner here. If not, we will run the YouTube. Okay. Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, anyway, so what President Trump said today was essentially that that people throwing rocks at U.S. soldiers on the border would be treated as if that if they were rifles. Okay, well, here's the problem that I have with that, ladies and gentlemen. We have the technology. We have the technology to prevent that from even needing to be an issue. I don't know if you guys are familiar with active denial technology. But if I were Trump and I was giving that speech, I'd say, hey, y'all, come on up to the northern border. We got one wicked of a suntan for you. And I just let it be at that. We wouldn't be pariahs in the international community. We wouldn't have to be doing the same things that Israel does. Now, and I know that's not really a comparable situation, because it's not like we've, you know, in the past 50 years, we went in and stole a portion of Mexico. We fought over that a long time ago. So, you know, that being said, it's not comparable in the aspects of the direct situation. However, a border fence, a border wall, men, women, children, kind of similar to a protest when they're trying to rush in, but not really. But see, I look at it that way because I know our technology, right? I really don't worry about this. Everybody's all up in arms about this. You put three units active denial technology on these three points in the border, you'll spin those folks right back so fast it'll make their head spin. End of problem. Drops mic. Nobody's dead. Nobody's killed. Nobody's shot. No snipers. None of that. You don't need any of that. None of our soldiers have to be in harm's way. They don't even have to get close. And I'm not really advocating for active denial technology, except that I would much prefer them to use that than to use bullets, right? I mean, that's kind of like, as a Christian, that's kind of like, if I don't have to kill you, I'd really rather not, right? Wouldn't that be cool? I mean, God forbid that we think like that, right? Just saying. So anyway, that's kind of where I am on that. All right, where are we at with this live stream? Come on now. This has been, we've been waiting for this to hit at 7 o'clock. It is live. Go. Patch in.
You're watching No More News.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Adam Green here with No More News. It is Thursday, November 1st, 2018, and I have a very special show lined up for us tonight, because tonight we have the Jake Morfonios from the Blackstone Intelligence Network. So before we go to Jake, let me gush over him a little bit, because I've been trying to write up an introduction for Jake all day, because he really deserves the best introduction. I can't say enough good things about him. I got the privilege to spend the last week with him while we were in Palestine, and I was really just blown away by his professionalism, his courage, his poise. He's long been one of my most respected and admired YouTubers. I've been a follower of his for a number of years. He's really the most informed, intelligent, articulate people out there. And his commentary and analysis is second to none. I'm proud to say, call him my friend. Thank you so much, Jake, for coming on. I know you don't do a lot of interviews, so it really means a lot for me for you to be here. And I know my audience, already most of my audience loves you, and I think we have a lot of mutual followers. So thank you so much for being here. How you doing?
Hey, Adam, I'm doing great. Thank you for that awesome introduction. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you so much for being here, Jake. So this interview is a long time coming, right?
Oh, yeah. We've been talking about it for a while. We were talking about doing an interview, oh, goodness, back when we were first talking about going to Palestine together, but we had to kind of keep things quiet. Didn't want too many people out there, too many of the wrong people to know that we were collaborating behind the scenes.
Exactly, yeah. So even before we got invited to go to this Palestine trip, which we've been really secret about it, we're taking every precaution to not alert the authorities, so they blocked us from coming in, but we can say it now. We're not going to give the official name of who invited us, but it was a Palestinian Cultural Exchange Delegation Program. So, you know, they basically brought us over there so we could learn about what's going on and come back home and kind of report on what we saw, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So I was a big fan of yours, and I was already seeing in your comments and people telling me, get Jake Morfonius on the show, get him on the show. So the fact that I was so honored to be invited to go to this thing, and when I heard you were going, I instantly said, if Jake's going, I'm in, even though I wasn't sure about the program. I thought, as far as I knew, it could have been Mossad trying to lure me over there to get my head chopped off or something. So
Yeah, and the funny thing is that's how we think, because, you know, I was kind of thinking the same thing, like Adam Green. I've never really spoken much with Adam Green. He's somebody that I'm not super familiar with yet, and he doesn't know me a whole lot yet, so who's playing who here? Could he be part of some effort to get me over there and knock me off in the desert or something? So I'm sure we were doing a little background research on each other. But it just goes to that this kind of paranoia that we live with is really nothing in comparison with what the Palestinian people have to live with on a daily basis. I can see why they feel the way that they do. And you know, that paranoia pays off right there from the beginning in my little Greensboro airport. A man with a keffiyeh and his companion were following me around, and that's something that I talked about a little bit. I had family members and others saying, you're kind of crazy to go over there to Israel or to Palestine. These people are crazy, the intelligence over there. And it really is, but you know, it's like we're living in a period of, it's like history in the making. We watch all of these World War II movies and all of the intrigue and the things going on there, but really there is no regime that is as diabolical in the world, past, present, or future, probably, than the modern Zionist state of Israel. These people are fascist to the core.
I agree. Yeah, it really is ruthless. The trip for me, I wouldn't say that it was eye-opening, because I already knew that there was alarming things going over there, but I would say that it was life-changing, and that almost my... it's almost worse than I thought it was, and then better than I thought it was in certain ways. So what are your overall impressions from the trip? I know you're going to, you announced today that you're going to do a multi-part mini doc series, so you can tell us some more about that too.
Yeah, so I guess really what got me started on this subject in general was back in the 1990s. I had lived in the early 90s overseas in Thailand and lived there for a couple years. And I came home, and one of the things that I did when I came back to the United States was I was asked by my church to start teaching this basically a college-credited high school course on the Old Testament. And so I, being a history major, I thought, hey, this will be fun. I'll learn all about Middle Eastern history and geopolitics and you know, compare that with what I knew of the Bible. And so I got studying, and I really started learning about the history of the Middle East, or at least there in the area of Palestine, and how ancient Israel interacted with its neighbors and so forth. And so from there, I kind of... I wouldn't call myself necessarily a Christian Zionist, but I was someone who early on had that mentality that, Israel has a right to defend itself against these terrorists that are always trying to destroy them. I didn't know a whole lot about the Palestinian side of the story. But I try and stay open-minded. I try and listen to both sides. That's just seems like the smart thing to do, hear both sides. So I listened to the Palestinian side, those that were debating that side. I was a member of a really big debate group, online debate group, and we talked about, you know, Middle Eastern politics all the time. And so gradually I came to understand, wait a second, Israel is not what I thought it was. They are heavy-handed. Their responses to any kind of what they consider provocation is just radically inappropriate response to the whatever the provocation is. And so I looked at it and I started feeling a lot more empathy for the Palestinians. And so over the years, I've continued studying, and as I've looked into other topics that people would consider, you know, the typical conspiracy theory genre, 9/11 and the JFK assassination and all of these things over the years, I've seen the common thread, which is Israeli intelligence involved in a lot of it, the Mossad and so forth. And so as time went on, I just started feeling angry that these people, the Palestinians, were being subjected to so much abuse and nothing was happening on the international stage. There would be occasionally some murmuring from the United Nations or from the European Union. But because the United States was always covering for Israel, really nothing was ever happening. So that kind of made me indignant. So a lot of the reporting that I've done in the last 20 years has been on the role of Israel in the world and how it's destabilizing not only the Middle East but the entire planet.
You've really been navigating these really taboo, stigmatized subjects with such professionalism, and you're able to really wake up so many more people that would otherwise be deterred from looking into these kind of things.
My background was in politics, political campaigning. I worked as a campaign manager and strategist for several candidates, state and federal level candidates. And the goal was, during the primary season, you want to appeal to your base, those that are maybe a little more, not necessarily radical, but the diehard people in your base. But then once you get through the primary, you got to swing way to the middle and appeal to the people in the middle, because what wins the election is not your fired up base. It's the people that you can pull to your side from the middle. And so it's a different kind of campaigning, a different kind of rhetoric. It's not about being dishonest, but it's about trying to speak to people in a way that they can hear and they can relate to, in a way that is not overtly offensive, a way that you can talk to them and open up their minds and get them to listen to what you're saying. Because the facts, usually most people, when they hear facts undiluted, straight, in a non-offensive way, they can make up their own minds. We don't so much have to convince people as we have to present the ideas, show them how it matters to them, and show them how they can transition to our side. And what I have found with the Israeli-Palestinian issue is just that. So many people out there are already polarized when it comes to this issue. And so if you start out the conversation in a browbeating way, or a way that it just comes across as offensive to a lot of people, it's a non-starter. So you don't win people to your side. You may fire up your base, but that's not sufficient to win. And for me, the issue here is, I don't want to just talk about the issues. I want to help bring about meaningful change. And that means we need to get more people on our side. So I get criticized sometimes for not naming the Jew or going after Jews hard enough. But, you know, while I understand where folks are coming from, my strategic goal is not in alignment. It just the the naming the Jew kind of mentality does not necessarily work for what I'm trying to do, for the people that I'm trying to reach. And so that's why I take the approach that I do. Appeal to people's logic, to their sense of compassion, and do it in a way that opens them up rather than just going hardcore. That's not to say that those that take that position are not right in many, many ways. In fact, they are. There is a great, dire threat in the world today, and it's and the world Jewry, it's not a small percentage. It's a large percentage of them that feed into this supremacist mentality and that pool their resources together to help bring about their goals. So I understand it, and I do agree with it. But it comes back to me feeling like my best approach is to reach those that I have the potential to converting over to our side. And then once they start this direction, it's kind of like taking that red pill and starting to see the world around you, the matrix as it really is. Once you start to see it for yourself, you don't need anyone to convince you. You convince yourself. The reality convinces you. And so those people will figure out for themselves what the real problems are.
Well, you're doing a phenomenal job of navigating this complicated landscape and doing a great job of waking people up. You got a huge platform, lots of followers, and it's so impressive the amount of quality and quantity of content that you're putting out on a consistent basis. So you're doing a great job. Enough about you and enough about us. I wanted to show you real quick. This is a little thing of the wall I made for your bumper. So your fans over at Blackstone Intelligence Network will appreciate this one. Here we go. Oops. Here we go. Restart it. So that is the wall, right? Right across from where Banksy's walled off hotel is. And yeah. Here's the photo here. So you went in tell us what you did here to get this on the wall.
So this wall is massive. It's, what was it, like 29 meters tall or something? I don't even remember. But there's no chance anyone's going to scale this thing. It's huge. And then you've got the barbed wire up at the top and turrets around there where people, the IDF can take you out with a sniper rifle if you do try and climb it. So on the Palestinian side, there's this little shop where a shop owner makes supplies available to people that want to, spray paint a message on it. So I went in there and got some cardboard and just kind of traced out a stencil and cut it out, and we went out there and spray painted it, and it felt good, felt really good. I keep here. I've got a piece of the Berlin Wall. I've had a handful of different pieces. This one came in a case, and I remember so much about the Berlin Wall and the East and West Berlin and the troubles between the East and West fighting over Berlin and the number of people that were killed trying to cross. And so we've got this modern day Berlin Wall, this apartheid wall. And so I thought it was cool. Maybe one of these days that wall will come down and little pieces of it will be broken up and someone out there will get the, a piece of the Blackstone Intelligence spray paint mounted up there.
Yeah, here's the wall right here. I got a little a photo of the where we were at. So I want to talk to me about and tell everybody about the video that you did today. That is you announced that your series that you're gonna do. So I want to let everybody know about that and make sure that they're following you so that they can see those. When can we expect to start seeing those videos coming out?
Probably the first segment will probably come out tomorrow. So here's what I'm doing. I'm going to start. I want to take the experiences that we had over there, the testimonies that people gave, and I want to use that material in a way to help wake up more
Anthony
people.
Bourdain.
So I'm going to make a documentary. It's going to be somewhere between an hour and a half to 2 hours. And so rather than make it all at once and release it all at once, I'm going to release it in segments, probably 5 to 10 minute segments, one every couple of days, try and make it as professional as I can, telling the story of not only the history of how this disaster, this catastrophe happened to the Palestinian people, but what life is like right now as the people have to deal with things, for example, like these racist, angry and violent Jewish settlers in places like Hebron and Jerusalem and elsewhere. I want the world to see what's going on in a non-sensationalized way where they can look and say, geez, I had no idea. I had no idea this is what it's really like over there. Because if you watch Fox News or CNN or any mainstream media in the United States or even in Europe, you will never, ever know what it is really like in the Palestinian territories, because it's whitewashed. And that's something that I think that you would probably agree, Adam, when we were over there, there were a lot of people from adults down to children. And as we talked with them, they were shocked at the lack of international response. And even what some of the school kids were saying is, why aren't you doing something? How can you let this happen to us and not come to help us? Well, the reason for that, more than anything else, is the West doesn't know what's happening. They don't know how much evil is going on. They don't know about the oppression. They don't know about things like the settlers throwing bottles of urine down onto the Palestinian shopkeepers in the old city there in the Muslim quarter. They don't see these things. They don't know about all of the shootings of protesters or the detainment of people that are just trying to walk down the street. So I want to put together this documentary and spread it. Spread it as far and wide as I can to as many people as possible and get a conversation going. And then after the documentary series is over, I'm hoping that I can start it in December, but I'm going to organize a speaking tour and go around at least the East Coast. I don't know yet if there would be sufficient funding for me to go further out to go out west. But I want to go on a speaking tour and distribute these documentary DVDs to people and talk about the issues and try and wake as many people up, because really what it's going to come down to for change to happen in Palestine, people from the West are going to have to pressure our governments, pressure the United States, pressure the UK, pressure Australia to relent in this unquestioning support for Israel. The funding, United States gives $3.8 billion in financial assistance to Israel every single year. And the little bit of assistance that the Palestinians were getting was U.S. funding to a U.N. agency, UNRWA, UNRWA, which Donald Trump has cut. So
we met the little girls in the refugee camp where that cut came right out of their budget for their school. And they were basically like crying to us, like, why is your government doing this to us? The blood is on our hands, and like they're doing this in our name. And if we're not speaking up against it, then we're going along with it.
Exactly. It's not like funding was going to finance some kind of Palestinian military or something like that. This was funding that was going directly to support refugee camps, the education of the students, basic medical supplies, the most basic kinds of food just to keep them alive. The problem is, if you take on, if we support, if our government support, for example, in Gaza, if we support the Israelis in surrounding Gaza turning it into a prison camp, putting tanks and all kinds of Israeli weapons around to guarantee that no one can get out, building a giant fence around it, having snipers set up to shoot anyone that comes near this this illegal fence, blockading any potential exits, stopping the imports of goods into Gaza, jacking up the unemployment rate to, you know, 60%, 70% as a result of all of these cuts, and even right down to, I kid you not, in Gaza, Israel bans surfboards. It is illegal to import or to own a surfboard in Gaza, even though they're sitting right there on the Mediterranean coast. Why? Because who knows, maybe one of these Palestinians could get on their surfboard and sail away from Gaza. So if we are going to keep these people trapped like animals in a pen, it then becomes our responsibility to take care of them. Now, I would rather not have to, and I'm sure that the people of Gaza would prefer that they wouldn't need any international help. But if we cut off their ability to take care of themselves, to feed themselves, to do business with other nations, if we take all of that away, their deaths are on our hands. And that's the problem. And that's why it's so outrageous that the Trump administration has cut off the little bit of support that they were getting, because it guarantees that there are going to be a lot of deaths from starvation, from malnutrition, from other kinds of health problems. They can't even get the most basic care that they need at hospitals and so forth.
All they want is dignity. That's the word I kept hearing from. They want dignity. They want freedom to travel. It's like they're systematically dehumanized and they're humiliated, and it's like they leave no stone unturned, and there's just like no empathy for these poor people. And it's just like we have to speak out. I feel like after going there and witnessing that and seeing what I saw, I just have like an obligation and a responsibility, not just because this great group brought us over there to help raise awareness, just because, you know, once you see things, you can't unsee them. So I think I've experienced myself. It kind of lit a fire under my butt and like reinvigorated me. Have you felt the same since your trip over there?
Absolutely. This is something I have cared about for years, but the energy boost from being able to see it with my own eyes, not just watching on videos or talking with people by Twitter or whatever.
I've noticed your tweets have escalated a bit. I feel like you've got a little bit more spirit behind some of your tweets.
I've never been much of a Twitter user in the past. But it's true. After this trip, coming back from this trip, I just want to get the word out any way I can. And so I won't pull any punches on Twitter. I don't post anything that's graphic or that would violate what I think are reasonable standards. But I'm not going to pull any punches. And almost certainly I'll end up banned from some of these social media. But in the time that I have, I'm going to speak straight. And you know, I'm already getting plenty of hate from you know, Zionists, but it just goes with the territory. That's really how that's their MO. That's how they function. Is they try and scream and shame. They call you names. They call you anti-Semitic. Anything that they can do to try and turn you into to make you feel bad. They don't come to you. Not one, not in the years I've been doing this, has any Zionist come to me and argued with me based on the merits of their position. They can't, because their position is wholly immoral. It is immoral. It is illegal. It is illogical. It is unkind. And so they don't even try to argue. They'll throw out some of these vain platitudes. Israel has a right to defend itself. The Palestinians are terrorists. They may say a couple of those things, but they can't back it up. So all they have is shame. All they can do is try and shame you, intimidate you, flag your videos, try and get your videos on YouTube pulled, try and get your posts on social media pulled, accuse you of anti-Semitism. That's all they've got. They're cowards. They're weak. and they are cowardly, and we have the upper hand. We just need the courage to speak out and do it in a way that's again, the public out there has this. They don't really understand it. They don't understand that anti-Semitism is used as propaganda by a lot of people. So you have to approach it in a way that's not overt. I will hit them like crazy, left and right, without being coming across as a Jew hater. In fact, some of the hardest working anti-Zionists are Jews. And those that are in Israel with Bet Salem and other organizations, they are risking a whole lot more than we are to speak out against Zionism.
Several Palestinians we met talked about that how a Palestinian that stands up for the Palestinian struggle is a hero in their communities, and they're respected. But in Jewish communities, anybody that doesn't go along with the status quo is rejected as a traitor and really shunned strongly.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
So I wanted to get more into the censorship.
And they jail them on a regular basis. They will arrest Jewish activists who are speaking out for the Palestinians. They'll arrest them and throw them in jail. It's tough. It's tough.
So I wanted to back up and not go over all the details of the trip because, you know, that would take way too long. Both you and I are going to be putting out all the footage and many videos in the next few weeks or months. But I wanted to talk about the guys that were following you from your initial airport. This guy was wearing, I got mine right here. So this guy in your home state, where you don't see anybody wearing these, was sitting right across from you wearing the Palestinian scarf, right? Trying to get you to talk to him, probably.
We have virtually no Muslim community in the area of North Carolina that I live. We're not a very culturally diverse area. We've got this tiny little airport in Greensboro where most of the time, anytime I fly out of Greensboro, I don't have to wait. I'm the first in line at security. You just walk up and you go straight through. Very, very few people. So I go and I check in for this first leg of the flight to Tel Aviv. And I go up to the United ticket counter and I notice there's a couple people at the ticket counter next to me. But anyway, the agent says, all right, what's your name? And I say, Jake Morfonios. Now, out of my peripheral vision, I can see the people next to me, these two guys, spin and look straight at me. So I'm thinking that's unusual that they'd, you know. So I thought, well, maybe they're viewers, because I've met viewers every now and then that recognize my name. So I turned to look at them, you know, to, you know, greet them or whatever. And one of them quickly turns away. The other is like deer in the headlights locked. His eyes are wide and he's looking at me. So I start to grin and he turns around real quick. So they leave the counter. I finished getting checked in. I was there with my wife and one of my children. I had an hour before I needed to go through security. So I just decided to wait, to not go through security, just sit out front and wait. So these two guys were hanging out there nearby me, kept watching me. And I had told my wife what was going on. And so she was kind of spying on them when I would look away. And she was saying, yep, they're still staring. So we got up and we started walking around to different parts of the airport. And they followed. They followed anywhere I went. Finally, I decided to go through security. Went through the security gate there, went to my gate, and these guys follow me to the gate. And they sit down right next to me. I mean,
right,
like directly in front of me.
Yeah, you took a photo, and you put it up in a video, but you haven't put that back up yet. You need to change that one
Yeah, that's right. I need to release that from the make it public again. Yeah, I mean, they were close enough that I could have just bent forward and touched them. So I took a couple pictures. One of them was wearing the keffiyeh like you've got on there, mm-hmm. Which is just, like I said, we don't have Palestinian activists in our era.
And he didn't get on the next flight that you got on, actually going to Israel. So it didn't make any sense. Something else I want to mention. So when we were in on the East Coast doing our connecting flight, you go through normal security, but then to go to Israel, they're the most special country, I guess, because there's a whole nother level of security that you have to go through just to get to the one single gate where you fly out to go to Israel. And, the security was the theme we heard over and over again on the trip. It's the magic word that they use as the justification to do all the terrible atrocities that they do. It's for our security. It's for security. Pretty soon they're going to just be censoring any criticism of them whatsoever for their security.
Yeah. And it wasn't just in Greensboro. So we got on the flight. They were sitting in the seat in front of me on the flight from Greensboro to Newark. Once we got to Newark, I had to change concourses. I forget if I was in A and needed to switch to concourse C or vice versa, but very separate from each other. So I took a shuttle bus, rode on the bus from concourse A to concourse C, and they followed me. And so there were a bunch of shops there in that concourse. So what I would do is, since they were following me, I would walk and stop at a shop outside, like I was there to look at the, do some window shopping. They would then pass me and stop at the very next shop, and they'd do the same thing. They'd stand there looking the window and wait until I passed them, and then they'd fall in behind me again. And this happened for about four stores. And then they followed me all the way down to the area you're talking about, where I had to go through the additional security. And at that point, I'm guessing they had someone else that was on the flight that picked up the tail there. But they were so overt. They were so making it so obvious that they were following. Yeah, I don't think that they were trying to keep it a secret. If they were, they did a terrible, terrible job. I think the goal was to make sure I knew that I was being followed. They really made no secret about it. So it makes you feel uncomfortable. And then the pictures that you're showing there, these after we had come out of the Abraham Mosque, just walking down the street, there was this checkpoint there. And out of our whole group of people, they snagged me and ordered me to come over. So I was standing there, and they were interrogating me, saying, what are you doing here? What are these cameras for? They were asking me about my jacket. What is this jacket for? And demanded my passport and started making some phone calls in. I have no idea who they called, but they were calling something in about me. Eventually, I got my passport back and was able to keep going. But then later on, when you and I were speaking with the other Israeli security, the IDF or whoever it was, the girl down on the other side, when I was talking with her, she was pointing out that down there at that checkpoint where they had stopped me, just the previous day, security forces had shot and killed a Palestinian man who they said had a knife. And so there she is. There's that picture. So it's very possible that they were concerned that I was a journalist there to document their killing of that Palestinian. I don't know. That's just,
yeah, it was like 2 days before, like probably 20 feet away from this photo where this photo was taken here. This is the entrance to the Jewish side of the Abraham Mosque / synagogue. And, this is in Hebron. This is like, I'm sure going to be one of your best, mini doc series, because in Hebron there's so much crazy stuff. There was they murdered the Palestinian just here a few days before we were there, and this is right where also they stopped you and were checking your passport, which is probably why you're showing up with all these cameras and selfie stick, and they don't want any. That's their worst fear, is having journalists come in there and document things and then just share the truth with the world. That's what they're most afraid of, which is really telling of what's happening over there. But go ahead.
It really is. And Adam, one thing that we noticed when we were leaving, there was a lot of concern about leaving, that perhaps we were going to have a whole lot of trouble trying to depart. That's what everyone told us. that we met with, and also what I had heard before I left, is that getting into Israel is a whole lot easier than leaving Israel, because what they're concerned about and what they stop you for and interrogate you about and hold you so you miss your flight, what it's about is not so much security. They're not worried all that much about people coming in and committing some acts of violence. What they fear is when you leave, if you've been out in Palestinian territories or areas where there's the IDF and these things, they know that you've seen things. They can't hide it. It's everywhere. So they're concerned about what are you going to say to the rest of the world when you get back? Mm-hmm. And so that's why they go through your stuff, looking for anything that indicates that you support the Palestinians. They may go through your SD cards on your camera and so forth, look at the kinds of pictures you took.
We had to export everything up to the cloud and send email to ourselves in case that they were going to. We heard horror stories of them destroying people's cameras or just plugging into your computer and just copying everything off of it while you're detained. So I was remember I texted you before the trip and I said, "Are you as worried as I was?" Because and I shared you the article of the young girl who was detained over her BDS support.
Yeah,
and it's like we went in there knowing that we may get detained and that we might not get in, but we're like, hey, at the very least, it'll be a 10-hour flight, and then we can make the news. It'll be a story, and we can highlight that they're keeping American journalists out from seeing the truth. But we got through, which possibly we're just under the radar. I'm not on Canary Mission. I don't know if you are. I
wasn't on Canary Mission before we left.
Yeah, we tried to privatize our social media accounts, and but there was no hiding you. You know, you're the only Jake Morfonios, and your work is everywhere. Yeah. Copied on other people's things. But we didn't know we were getting through, but we tried it. We made it through. I was scared as hell getting out several levels of interrogation, pulling out all my bags, getting a 5 out of 6 on the danger scale, having to leave with a group and all of us kind of not expose somebody else because, they ask you, they interrogate all of us. So if anybody gets the story mixed up and they figure out, hey, these people are together, there was a lot of stuff to worry about. I'm so happy we made it through. But it's funny that I knew going into this that if we made it in and we made it out clear, that people would say, oh, they're shills, they're agents, they were getting orders, which of course some of that happened. But at the same time, I think if something happened to us and we said, yeah, we were detained and all this happened, they'd just be like, you're making it up. So I don't really care what anybody says. I know it's the right thing to go over there, and we got the footage, and we're going to, I know you and I are going to be spreading this message for a long time now.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're going to hit this thing hard and keep it going. Your channel, you've been talking about related issues for a good while now and doing an excellent job there.
4 years.
Yeah. So it just really, this is just a turbo boost. This is still going in the same direction, but with a whole lot more, I would say, street cred, because having been there and seeing it, and as we put out more and more footage, people will see interviews that were done. They'll hear Palestinians themselves. One of the biggest surprises for me was that I did not feel, in the 9 or 10 days that we were there, I did not feel uncomfortable among the Palestinians a single time. They were as kind as anybody that I've ever been among. Nobody badmouthed me because I was an American, despite what my government has done to these people. They didn't treat me like, oh, you're just one of those dirty Americans. I could go on the street and speak to anyone. And what surprised me, first of all, is that most everybody could speak English. They were highly educated.
Educated and informed and just resilient and persistent. And the way that they're trying, the Israelis are trying to erase their history. The first day we met with the cultural preservation and conservation leaders in the community, and it was just heartbreaking hearing how the IDF shuts down little children's plays and concerts, and they're always messing with not allowing teachers in and shutting down the schools. And it's just like, any way possible, they leave no stone unturned to make life miserable for these people, because they just want them to leave. They're trying to break their spirits and make them leave and just make their lives, humiliate them and make their lives a living hell, as horrible as possible.
That's what it is. It's a racist supremacist mentality. Mm-hmm. They think they're better than the Palestinians, and it just saturates their behaviors, it's like a nation full of KKK members. They're so racist. toward the people. I was watching today, getting some footage, permission to use some footage for my documentary I'm working on. I got some footage of just mobs of Jews in Jerusalem walking through the streets, waving flags, singing about how Arabs are sons of bitches and all need to go to hell, and all their women are whores. and you know, it's horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible the way that they treat the right. Palestinians.
One of the best examples of the treatment is definitely in Hebron, which the one thing we were told is don't say anything about Hebron when you go through security, because this is like the place that they don't want anybody knowing about. I already put out the video yesterday called A Palestinian Shopkeeper's Message to the World. And this is the type of information that mainstream, you're not going to see on mainstream media. We were just walking through the market in Hebron, one of the oldest cities in the world, one of the oldest markets in the world. And you can see in this video, they have the fence above the market because the settlers are right smack in the middle of the Palestinian village in the West Bank that's supposed to be Palestine's territory. And they throw rocks, they throw garbage, they throw feces and urine and pour bleach on the people down below. And then you can see in the video, it's just there's like little kids walking by where all this stuff is happening. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
So we'll play that right there. So, and this is in Hebron, and then this shopkeeper is just saying, we don't deserve to be treated like this. You know, please share the message with the world. And this is the type of stuff that you don't ever see. That's the comment I saw most often is, wow, you'll never see this on mainstream media. Like a true, you know, just a shopkeeper telling what's going on to him over there. And then also at the mosque, which that was an amazing mosque, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really cool.
The 1994 massacre that happened there, the Goldstein massacre, where he went in, which just is almost exactly like the synagogue shooting. So he goes in, murders 29 Palestinians who are worshiping in the mosque, and then afterwards they go and do interviews with all this guy's friends and all the settlers that are around there, and they were celebrating. They were still celebrating what he did and saying it was a good thing. They're not condemning it. That would be like if this latest synagogue shooting happened and you and me and a bunch of people in America were just saying, yeah, he did the right thing. That was awesome. He's a hero. Like that's the level of racism that we're dealing with over there in occupied Palestine.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It doesn't cross our minds to celebrate what happened at the synagogue in Pittsburgh.
It's terrible.
In
it's
fact, we had just, you and I had just gotten off the plane when I checked my phone for latest stories, and I saw that we had just landed in Newark, and I remember walking up to you and reading the headline from Haaretz, a Jewish publication, you know, about this shooting that had just happened. And the first thing out of your mouth was, how awful. How could they possibly think this is a good thing, you know, to do this?
It's the worst it's the worst thing that could ever happen for our cause and for the truth.
Yeah, it's a morally repugnant thing that we just don't celebrate in any way. But we would never never think to go out and make a song. I don't even remember the name of the shooter, but can you imagine making a song and just going out and tons of people knowing the song, praising this guy for his murder of these Jewish worshipers? And yet that's what they do in Israel I think his name was Baruch Goldstein. But I got
a little clip of it played up. I'd like to play for somebody real quick, yeah. and see the mindset of some of these people over there in Hebron. You can hear it, right, Jake?
Pain piercing the air, yeah, in the town of Hebron this morning after the bloody massacre.
800 Palestinian worshippers gathering for the holy fasting month of Ramadan. But unknown to them, many had also come to die, victims of a madman's fury. The steady scream of ambulance sirens pierced the Israeli morning as body after body was removed from the Ibrahim Mosque. It was just after dawn when the attack came. The worshippers were kneeling in prayer. Suddenly, Dr. Baruch Goldstein, a Jewish settler from New York City, slipped in, blocked the only exit, and opened fire. His assault rifle spit bullet after bullet. Hand grenades exploded, ripping into human flesh.
So this is the mosque that you and I visited. We walked all around it. It's where Abraham and his wife, his family, Sarah and Rachel and Isaac, were all buried. And the most terrible thing is that after this massacre happened, this Jewish American settler goes in there and murders 29 Palestinians. And their answer was they split the mosque in half and gave half of it, turned half of it into a synagogue.
Yeah. Yeah, what if in Pittsburgh, what if the guy was upset because, I don't know, let's say he's Christian, and so he goes in there and shoots up the people, and the response of the U.S. government is to say, the way we're going to resolve this is we're going to split that Pittsburgh mosque in half and give it half to the Christians because, you know, that's the right thing to do. It's just outrageous, but that's exactly what they did with
another,
the mosque.
Yeah, another observation I noticed over there in occupied Palestine was the double standards, the total lack of empathy on the Zionist side, and then just everything is like a hypocrisy. It's like they always use the law to screw over the Palestinians. Like they'll say they have all these loopholes that you have to be planting on this land or we can confiscate it. But then at the same time, they steal all their water by digging lower than the Palestinians are allowed to dig and then drying up their springs.
Right. Yeah. It's shocking. Shocking that even the most basic things on their own land, they cannot dig a normal well. They have to get their water from the Israelis, they have to pay the Israelis, and they can't have water every day of the week. 2 to 3 days a week, they're allowed, which is why the Palestinian homes, have to have reservoirs that they store water in, because they don't know, there's no guarantee that Israel's going to turn the water back on for them. And they can't irrigate their crops that they're trying to grow things on, grow food on, and since they don't get the water to be able to do that, and Israel says you have to be growing something here to keep the land, well, it guarantees that the Israelis are going to have justification to go in and take the land from them. It's dirty, dirty, dirty.
There's also all types of dirty corruption involving like the home permits too, and justifying all the bulldozing of the homes. It's so sad. You know, the housing minister over there, I have a headline of him saying that Al-Aqsa and the Dome will be removed and it will be replaced by the Third Temple. That's what the housing minister, the guy that's overseeing all the bulldozing of the homes and the kicking out of the Bedouin communities and all that. That's what he's saying. How brazen is that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's incredibly provocative.
Yeah.
Incredibly provocative. And we were there. I used to wonder, just looking at pictures, you know, I wonder if some crazy Israelis might go in there and, you know, try and blow up the Dome of the Rock or something to justify, you know, since it's already blown up, we'll just go in and build the temple over it. But it's a huge structure, and Al-Aqsa Mosque itself is a very large compound. You couldn't just blow it up with like a bomb. You would have to go in there and it would have to be like a drone strike, multiple missiles to go in there and blow that up enough
There's been plots before. There was plots by the Jewish underground in 1984 that were foiled. And now there's Haaretz articles saying that some members of that group have now gotten back into power in the Israeli politics.
They're becoming more extreme. The government is already very right-wing, and it is swinging further right. And the voices of those that are more moderate in the Knesset are drowned out. They have no power. They have no power to do anything. And we heard over